Started, I guess, if you're ready.
I am. First of all, thank you for taking some time today, Mike. I think I've been kind of gelling on this for a while, obviously. I ask you a lot of questions in a variety of different contexts. And so I was hoping to string a bunch of them together and build a little bit more of a clear picture about what your spiritual journey has been like and kind of how you've gotten to the place that you are today. So that's awesome. I know a little bit about it, but I'd like to kind of dive in. So some of this I may be hearing again, but there might be some more details and things that you can drive into a little bit. So I do go ahead and correct me if I'm wrong. I know that you have a little bit of religion in your upbringing, but that also your encounter with ufology also played a role in kind of how you unfolded into your spiritual path. So can you tell me a little bit first about the upbringing and kind of what impact that had on you as you headed into adulthood?
Yeah, I suppose a lot of my childhood was probably an echo of previous things and just trying to get my bearings on many different distortions. And I feel like my spiritual path did not develop strongly in my teenage years, except for, I guess, on a personal level, just personal lessons. I feel like that's a large part of our spiritual journey, is just the personal lessons more so than the spiritual studies or what we perceive as spiritual studies necessarily. And I certainly read the Bible, read the New Testament when I was a kid, and that was part of our, you know, our church upbringing with the Assemblies of God Church. They had me in a program called Royal Rangers, which was very, it's a little bit like Boy Scouts, and it's like that taught me a lot of life skills and a little bit more discipline, I guess, with reading the Bible. But that was a small part of my life, and it was like the bigger part was maybe in my teenage years listening to pastors with a lot of different philosophies about the value of spiritual texts in the Bible, especially. And but I ended up turning, I would say, somewhat into a narcissist in the sense of overconfidence in the fundamentalist way of perceiving things. And it was almost like that narcissism sort of spring-loaded me to question, how did I end up here? You know, and so the humility that came with the discovery of the ufology subject was the biggest factor on my spiritual growth, I think, because I recognized that I did not know what I did not know. And I was assuming that I could know everything I needed to know from what people had already written about the Bible. And that was very little having to do with, you know, recent testimonies from people who are in the government and military experiencing these strange things. And that's just, it's just obviously overlaid in some kind of way with the angels and the demons of the Bible and the weird aspects of the past that get recorded that aren't fitting into nice boxes yet. And so there's just endless mystery and endless puzzles that nothing had prepared me for that. And also the fact that when you, at least back in 2006, when I felt like I started to wake up to when I basically discovered the Disclosure Project, Stephen Greer's project to get a lot of different witnesses to testify together, that opened me up to the possibility that I had to do a ton more research on my own and not just trust what anyone was saying. So it was the fact that I had to throw everything out to get deeper to the truth. It also led to some conflicts with the people in my life that led me to believe that I can't just be arrogant in my beliefs at all anymore. I have to be humble to actually get anywhere with helping people. So that led to many, many layers of breaking down walls and barriers, and that, you know, eventually when I first tried to, well, there was an experience I had in 2012, which was basically the age of like 28, 27. Yeah. I basically finally broke down and built a large pyramid with the help of my dad. I built a pyramid. And once I had a pyramid constructed, for meditation, I decided to use my Bitcoin and try some large dose of LSD. And that was a huge breakthrough for me also to completely, I had what would be called an ego death experience. And that kind of tore away my assumptions of separated identity. It's hard to put into words what that is like, but it's like, there's no more sense of me in the sense that I had come to know me. And it's like, I'm more like a wave on an ocean. And so all the arrogance and narcissism just kind of is like an embarrassing side note to the recognition of the deeper truth of the mind, body, spirit energies, which are floating within a sea of consciousness, which, you know, I could call any part of it myself, but the reassociation of the nature of identity seems to be a more central part of the journey. That psychedelics certainly seem to help with that redevelopment of the capacity to perceive into the subconscious structures where our sense of self is coming from, our sense of identity. And ultimately, what I feel has been valuable is the recognition that the reassociation with the sense of self, the sense of identity, when you have a solid religious footing for that, it can be a much easier process to say, I'm no longer identified with the separate self, the old self, the flesh. I'm identified with the infinite spirit. I'm identified with Christ. I'm identified as Christ. And that kind of allows me to pull back up all the roots from the teachings of Christianity and kind of leverage those to just work on becoming like Jesus. And that just, it no longer means just trying to emulate him. It means, you know, allow my identity to be subsumed in him.
Yeah, 100%. Well, you definitely touched on a few different things that we're going to dive into a little bit further. But as we're still on the ufology, kind of the origin aspect of when you started to kind of open up to a wider world of possibilities. Tell me about the first time that you saw a UFO, the first time that you were absolutely certain that what you just saw was definitely a UFO by, I'll say, any classification, whether it would be man-made or extraterrestrial in origin, but that you saw a craft that you knew was doing things that are otherwise not possible.
Well, I can share this story, but it feels a little bit like skipping ahead because of the experiences I had with Stephen Greer's training group, which were,
well, let's start with those. If those lay good groundwork, let's start with those.
Yeah. Then. Yeah. So yeah, when I first started doing heavy research and I discovered Stephen Greer had this group that was going out and, you know, he charged less money, but then going out to different locations where were considered UFO hotspots and doing training, which would be basically meditation and guided meditations and attempts at remote viewing. But the most profound experience I had there was the event when some people were sitting in a circle, maybe 30 people in a circle out in Joshua Tree National Park. After having done several meditations, there was one point at which people sitting on the opposite side of the circle from me said that they were hearing a strange noise out in the field and wondering who else could hear that. And it seemed as though only a small number of people could hear it. And it was a strange thing that they were insisting that there was this sound out there. And then it started visiting other people. The sound started visiting other people in the circle, seemingly. And when it finally got to me, I didn't say anything and no one else said anything. No one said, I hear that too. I hear that. So that was very eerie. It was as though the sound was projected like a laser or something into certain people's ears. And, you know, my mind was racing, of course, how could that possibly be? But at some point, it's almost like my mind was calmed down and I realized this is just an extremely highly advanced intelligence that is interacting with people in the ways that they're ready, at the timing that they're ready. And that continued through many different experiences, recognizing that whatever this thing was, it was very cautious in how it was approaching people and giving people just enough so that they're not afraid and just enough to become aware that they're real. Because that's a huge problem, I think, for these groups that contact people, that people's egos can get in the way, and there's all kinds of attachments and distortions that result from the experience itself that can be unintended consequences, even if the original experience that the person has in the short term is a very inspiring or uplifting kind of experience, can be unintended side effects of the long term. So that to me was very eerie, but it felt like I was connected to something and they were watching my thoughts. And there were many other experiences gradually over time that built up that made me realize that I'm sort of in a telepathic exchange, which culminated with some of my first, obviously this is a ship experiences, which was several months into later, maybe 4 or 5 months, maybe 3 or 5 months in the future. I was meditating alone in a park in Southern California, called Mason Park, just inside of Irvine, California. And that, it was intentional meditation around midnight, just late in the evening, pretty much after I graduated from college. I just didn't have any job yet. I decided to spend a lot of time. I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, really. Because I thought I wanted to make video games, and then I had to question a lot of things. And I spent a lot of time meditating in the park. And I think the most strong experiences that I suspect that I saw what I would call shooting stars before I said, oh gosh, that's them. Because of one experience in particular I remember was, like, they were talking to me in my head, and they were talking with words, like responding to my thoughts and saying, Mike, we love you, Mike, it's okay. And it was as though there was this attempt to calm my mind down and open me up to love. And there was some experience of great love, of forgiveness. And this happened at different times, so I'm kind of mixing them together, but there were different experiences where I was brought to a state of forgiveness. And then a very, very bright flash appeared in the sky, right where I was looking. And then I had to actually stop and question, wait a minute, is that them? So it was that first question, is that them? And then they appear again when they want to confirm that kind of thing. And so there were several experiences like that. There was one experience I had where it was actually, literally, I was thinking about Jesus. And I was like on the fence, like, so what is the deal with this giant mechanism of religion that we're dealing with Christianity? Should I put any work into that at all, and into pursuing that? But when I was thinking specifically about Jesus, what do you guys think about Jesus? Then it was like just this fireworks kind of show, and then they said, I mean, it was all white lights. It wasn't colored lights, but it was like they were trying to overwhelm me with love at that moment, saying, like, you have no idea how much we love Jesus. You have no idea.
Big fans, so I beyond.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was very meaningful to me.
Beautiful. And when was the last time you encountered what you were certain was a UFO, and what was that encounter like?
Well, at the UFO Watchtower where you were present, was this just 2 weeks ago now? Yeah. So after we did the meditation, I remember being sitting in a chair, and Paul was talking about a potential place we could do. Of course, we had many experiences that night, but the one that stood out to me the most was when Paul was talking about a potential location we could do the next one. And then I was the only one who saw a bright flash. I think no, there was one or two other people said they saw it. Yeah, directly above.
Was this the one directly above? Yeah. Yeah, I actually saw that one too, and that was actually probably among the very first ones that I've seen, actually, that I would say, yeah, that actually exhibited behavior that I cannot otherwise explain as a plane or a satellite, which is actually pretty easy, or an asteroid or something like that. It's pretty easy to explain most things in the night sky, and most of the times I've gone out, that's what I've seen. But this behaved a little differently. Why don't you describe it?
Well, I mean, it was literally just a white ball that appeared for a split second and disappeared. and no movement to it, from what I remember. And it was brighter than any star in the sky. And it seemed like there were clouds there. There was no other stars around it. So it seemed like it was not like the clouds were moving. It was brighter than anything that would have been behind the clouds. That was my memory of it.
I think I might have saw a different one then, because it was moving, but it had sort of appeared kind of mid sky really. And that could have materialized from coming from behind clouds that are maybe darker or harder to see, but it was moving, in a straight line. And then it did a power up. Like it flashed mm-hmm. a real bright, brilliant white light just one time. Yeah. And then faded back to kind of what it was, and then it faded out of the sky. And so that one single flash is, unless you're getting glinting, which, you know, can happen obviously over on the other horizon at just the right time. But I don't think this was anywhere near there, because this was much later at night and it was directly overhead.
Yeah. And it's free will preserving that people can dismiss it as their iridium flares and that kind of thing. It's interesting.
Indeed. Show just enough, right? To it be whatever you decide that it is.
Yeah.
Okay. If you had to guess, what do you think open contact will look like? And I mean, specifically, I suppose, one, presuming that you do think that it's going to happen, and perhaps in our lifetimes. I'm not sure if you're probably familiar with some of Bashar's predictions around timelines, I think, in the next few years. But what I'd really like to know is whether you think that the impact on humanity would be more readily apparent in a kind of spiritual and vibratory fashion, in sort of the knowledge, sort of how this opened you up, for example, earlier on. Do you think that's what sort of the more immediate impact would be, or do you think that it would be more of a technological impact, and that the impact on sort of, you know, humanity's collective consciousness would take more time?
This is a huge, huge question with many threads to it, and I'm influenced by what people have predicted about the future. Corey Good, especially, the Law of One to a degree. The Law of One books have very, very small hints at the nature of what is likely and possible, and they actually hint that the negative groups are more likely to want us to be seeing things, to become afraid, and be more easily manipulated. And to some degree, we're already in a consciousness, mass consciousness state where a very large portion of religious groups will automatically interpret anything as being tricks, as being deceptive, and therefore must be the demons. And so it's extremely precarious situation to open us up to mass contact at this particular point in time, when people are not ready to even work together on talking about what these things could be rationally. You know, it's just, there's so much fear around it that gets in the way.
Would your presumption then be that if open contact did happen in the next few years, that it would be by a negatively polarized entity because of that fact that we're unprepared?
Well, it depends what you mean by open contact, but I think it's going to be, but the Law of One also does talk about the fact that there are the positive groups that are kind of trying to counterbalance every negative experience that is, the quarantine has not been properly adhered to in those cases when there is an overabundance of negative contact without the positive influences. So it's like an open doorway invitation for positive groups to come in and help correct things. And I think that might even happen in cases of abductions for people. There might be two different types of beings abducting to do two different types of work. But this is just so speculative. I'm still hidden behind, lost behind the veil, as you are on some level.
Sure. And but I think what you know, sort of how you opened up probably reflects what you're thinking on this is, which is that there's going to be a lot of, if it were to happen soon, there would be a lot of resistance to it.
Yeah.
And and therefore the impact, such as it could be even gleaned to be positive, would almost certainly have to be technological if it's going to take the rest of, you know, societies a long time to kind of catch up with and accept this. But in terms of what it means or how it's interpreted, I don't know. I mean, open contact, as I sort of understand it, or certainly as I refer to it, just means that it's absolutely undeniable contact. Like it's, you know, it's pervasive and it's fully evident with lots and lots of millions of eyewitnesses, et cetera, to where you can't really deny it anymore. Not to say that people wouldn't, but that the mental fortitude that it would take to be, you know, in continuous denial of that, I think would narrow the number of people down further and further, you know, who could actually achieve that and eventually have to just sort of accept it.
Yeah. I think this is happening more gradually than that, actually, with people like David Grush coming forward. And the upcoming year or two, we'll see a lot of people turning into believers just from the data that's coming out about what's already showed up. It doesn't have to be a particular event. It can be gradual, I think, because we've had so many events already. But I think that certainly it's possible that there could be an open contact scenario where groups who are ready to see it in a very positive light, who are ready to be ambassadors, they may be able to receive, when there's a collective calling, that there is definitely a need for a greater degree of contact. And there is some probably controversy in how to interpret the Law of One books when they talk about the allowance of the breaking of quarantine, but there really is no inherent limitation when they say certain groups can propose an idea of contact before the Council of Saturn, and then when they have that idea approved, then they're able to come and do some kind of experiment. And so if there are groups who are specifically ready to be on the forefront of helping to structure society around spiritual principles, where there's not a desire for control and power to manipulate others, where there's clearly a desire to simply educate and help others, I feel like there's an alignment with positive groups might have a doorway there to be of greater service without disrupting the free will and mass consciousness too much that way.
Let me ask you, this is sort of a related but side question, because it does have to do with this sort of karmic, you know, balance and positive and negative polarity, and Stephen Greer, actually. When we talk about the reverse engineered technologies, obviously his latest documentary, The Lost Century, is kind of bifurcated, and it's about both free energy and gravity control. And so I have this sort of, and I always love the thought experiment type things that we get into, because you have a way of seeing these things and helping me see them in a way that makes maybe a little bit more sense. And so I have this you know, this real dilemma, I suppose. We're trying to understand the nature of our galactic kind of neighborhood and the influences of information that have been allowed to flow in, and yet not to anyone that would open source the information. And I kind of have this sort of like, I want to ask some of, you know, these beings, almost like Reuben Langdon from, you know, Interview with ED. Like, he's got a whole show. That's all he does, is go and interview. And it's like, I'm just dying to know, why is it that that the seed information for these technologies keeps being fed into people, you know, that are in the inventor class and the, I'm going to be the next trillionaire class, and they're not handed to anyone that's just, you know, ready to just openly publish them to the world. That just seems really weird to me, right? Because as you describe these, the opportunities ought to be balanced, and, you know, this technology clearly has been within our grasp, our collective grasp, for a while. And yet we're, as the masses, still unable to have it. And it seems like this would be a very easy thing to deliver, given that it can be delivered telepathically to any one of probably millions of people who would, you know, instantly publish it and post it. So why are we still looking for this information?
Well, I think that a lot of it has been published and posted, and it gets taken down. And I think I've seen some of it. But I also think that Nikola Tesla is an example of somebody who was supposed to go down that road. He was one of the most angelic, they said, people in the Law of One, that he was ready to be of service to others to a great extent. And yet he still was able to be manipulated or twisted in his thinking, and is the way he was perceiving others who were probably not being very nice to him. And he probably thought that they were not ready for it, or that they wouldn't publish it widely. And, you know, possibly he was coming into the period of time where the information couldn't have been suppressed as easily as it is suppressed today, where it's, you know, it's possible that there are actually satellites that can detect when certain kinds of technology is fired up. And then that allows them to say, this is classified. We have to either buy this out or we have to put a stop to this in some way. And it's possible that there are many mechanisms that keep, because really there's a lot of very powerful interests trying to control the power. The sources of great power are things that can disrupt governments, militaries. So those sources of power have to be managed by the sources of power which are trying to maintain their control. And I think that's the dilemma right now. It's not necessarily that the information is not available. It's that the delivery of the information is still very tricky. And, you know, the internet can do a lot, but I haven't given up hope that this is there's a possibility that this could happen any day where something just goes so viral so fast under the radar that it makes it out. And yeah, I have hope that this could still happen. And it's, but I think that everyone is capable of being deceived, basically their own temptations to want more money or power or fame is still always there. So you can never completely eradicate it.
Probably doesn't help that there's so many hoaxes out there as well. I mean, if you go to YouTube and search free energy, you can just literally find hundreds of videos that purport to show exactly that. And yet, how do you tell one from the other? Well, Stephen Greer certainly implores his audience in that documentary to bring these things directly to him, and he'd be happy to have them tested in, you know, labs. And actually, they're building a lab to do exactly that, I think. And that he's got, I think he said it would be 24/7 live streamed of everything that they're doing at all times. So it would just always be transparent. Kind of a neat idea.
Yeah.
All right. Before we move on a little bit further into the trajectory here, if you could ask an ET anything, first of all, what type of ET would it be, and what would you ask?
Wow. That's challenging.
I think we know what I would ask. I would ask for free energy and gravity control.
Yeah.
Practical, clearly.
Yeah. I mean, it is like, what information is most lacking in the public consciousness right now that would be of most service? And like, how can I deliver that? It's like, yeah, I do feel like that's related to my life's purpose, is just figuring out how to deliver the information that is most needed and hasn't been said yet, or properly said, or said enough. And on some level, it's like, we're doing it with our discussion of the major arcana. Even it's like there's just layers of the onion, and the deepest layers are comprehending the patterns of intelligent energy, intelligent affinity that have chosen to manifest, and just coming back to the roots of why is everything the way that it is can help us process and piece everything together, I think, in a more coherent light.
So rather than have a or pose a one specific burning question for you as an individual, you might say, hey, what's the most important message I could deliver back to everyone else?
Right. Love that.
Okay, well, that's a great segue into the broader spiritual teaching. So we know that you had a relatively Christian sort of childhood, but that was maybe typical of most in that it was church and that sort of thing, but it didn't seem like it, you know, totally struck you until you got into maybe some more of the philosophy of it in your teen years. And then you encountered ufology that seemed to kind of have you rethinking everything that you thought you knew before. So how did you then embark on what you were going to then go explore? So obviously you started exploring disclosure and kind of what evidence there was and all the things, but then as you start to put your spiritual, you know, chaps back on here and venture out, what does that look like? Where did you start?
Well, I had learned in college that BitTorrent was the best way to share large amounts of data, large amounts of information. So I found a website that was called conspiracycentral.org, and it's called Cons, and it's shortened down to CONCEN.org. And they were sharing it's probably more popular back in the day before YouTube. This is like before YouTube. You could, and there was a period of time where Google Video, it was a service that where people were just uploading full-length documentaries without being censored. And that was a huge way to get a lot of information out for people. But before then, torrents were a very, very useful way. And so I was downloading like every single thing that I could find that I had never heard of from that website. And that included people's archives of books that would be many gigabytes worth of scanned PDFs of books and many documentaries, many just strange things that people thought was useful to know. It wasn't like conspiracy related necessarily. Sometimes it was strictly spiritual. Sometimes it was health related. And but eventually that led to things like discovering Project Camelot. And Project Camelot had an interview with David Wilcock, and David Wilcock was talking about the Law of One. And I guess at some point I also found out about A Course in Miracles pretty early on through a person named Chuck Anderson, who goes by Master Teacher of A Course in Miracles. Very interesting to listen to person.
Which one did you find first, the Law of One or the Course in Miracles?
A Course in Miracles I found first.
Okay.
But I didn't take it seriously until a few years later. I didn't seriously start doing the workbook until about the same time I started taking the Law of One seriously too, which should have been closer to 2008. This was 2006 when I started my research journey.
Out of curiosity, was that out of some sense of distance that you had put between you and kind of your Christian roots, and that the course kind of has a Christian, core to it, or you were just putting kind of everything in the middle pile, as you d discerned exactly what it was that was going to resonate in the long run?
Yeah, there wasn't any strong pull to one thing up until I found the Law of One. The Course in Miracles was just kind of like a giant question mark. It's like, what the heck is this? Because it was such an unusual kind of writing. And I didn't even put the pieces together that this was claimed to be the writings of Jesus or the channelings from Jesus. It was just like I was mesmerized by this particular teacher of the material. But I was also discovering Edgar Casey's material around then. And Edgar Casey, there was a CHM file that I found on a file sharing service, which had the Edgar Casey readings in a more digestible format that I could just plow through. And that was the best transition material for me to take Christian thinking and reinterpret many verses to what made way more sense. And Edgar Casey was a master of interpreting scripture in ways that made the most beautiful sense that I've ever seen. And the in this particular index of readings that you could browse by the chapters and verses of the Bible and everywhere he had referenced. And it's like his grasp and command of scripture was so vast. But
Was that
anyway,
because of the channeling, or because he was just taught and studied scripture?
I think it must be both, but I think he had built his consciousness in a framework that was thinking in terms of scripture. And he had probably a very strong memory of scripture from what I've seen in the documentaries. He was reading his Bible since he was a kid and had a very good command of scripture. But the obviously he was continuously reinterpreting it, I think, from his own readings and piecing things together, which incorporated eventually ideas of karma, reaping what you sow, and ideas of past lives, were for some people who were open to that, he would end up talking about past lives and how there's specific blockages, barriers that need to be worked through. And he would even bring in astrology to some degree, but the health information, the spiritual information, the simple guidance was usually profound in and of itself without having to go into any strange corners.
Was most of his channeling in sort of a lecture format?
Well, it was a lecture and then a Q&A. It was usually like people came with some general seeking, and then he would do a kind of lecture on that seeking. Like, here we have the subject. The subject is going through this. The subject has gone through this and needs to think about this. It might be benefited by this. And it's kind of like a doctor giving a prognosis or something. A overall treatment plan would be included in that.
Like a
And
metaphysician.
yeah, But he would literally prescribe specific tinctures and things that they could find, and he would know where what stores they could go to go find those things, so that they, you know, if something that was local to them, he would recommend that.
Wow, that's fascinating. So he was not just metaphysician, but also
it was mind, body, spirit. He saw the whole thing integrated.
Wow, that's beautiful. So what other, before we get into, I do want to ask you a few questions around the Law of One, since that's the one that seemed to grab so much of your attention, but help us understand what the rest of that picture looks like. I mean, how many other pieces have you pulled in your, you know, you're seeking to understand a greater picture?
Since I discovered the Law of One?
No, I mean, just in your overall journey in terms of other wisdom traditions or religions. I know that you've certainly spent more understanding things out of the East than I have, that's for sure, which still blows me away. It's like, I think you've done enough seeking, you know, for three or four lifetimes for a lot of people, but it makes being a spiritual seeking friend of yours wonderful. But how did you encounter any other traditions that were outside of what we talked about so far in the channel material?
Well, I mean, it's been little bits here and there where I come across people very reverent with the Tao, for example. The Tao Te Ching had an impact on me, and the Buddhist teachings were more easily approachable by listening to people like Alan Watts. And I'm sure I've studied other teachers, and the Hindu side of things, certainly with Ram Dass, was an incredible doorway into appreciating. Like, I don't know how I would have. I went from laughing at the idea of Hindu gods when I was in college. I remember having a friend who was Indian, and he had like a picture of, I think it was Ganesha. And I remember thinking, oh, that's so silly. And now it's like, everything's come back around, and it's like, oh, that's not silly at all. That's totally what I'm sure ETs look like. And, but the actual principles are buried a little bit deeper in some of the Hindu texts, but they're pulled out by certain Hindu teachers like Ramana Maharshi, and certainly Neem Karoli Baba has been a huge, huge influence. And that's just increased the way I feel connected to Neem Karoli Baba. And since 2017, I feel a strong pull to Ramana Maharshi's teachings too. And Ramana Maharshi just had so many interesting ways of looking at the nature of self and identity that were ultimately pulling us back into the one truth of the one supreme identity, which is above and beyond all. And his grasp of that in a way that he could verbalize was very profound. And it almost seems like other teachers reached that state, didn't risk as much by using as many words to describe that as Ramana Maharshi did, because it's probably easy to misinterpret what he's saying. And eventually people started to focus on, you know, some people have talked about Ramana Maharshi talks about there being a point in the body where the I is, the I thought is coming from. But now, of course, I'm appreciating the Kundalini as having more to do with that. If you're going to think about it, there's a position where you are, but that's not really related. We're beyond all space and time. It's just that we're tracing ourselves back to that which feels like it is in space and time, and then transcending that. But that's, you know, getting off on a tangent from the core teaching, which is basically just, who am I, is his core teaching, asking the question, who am I, and figuring out where that leads. Where does that question lead? And what is this I that we are presuming is a thing that has a nature, that has a thought, that we're somehow applying to something that's more real than just the thought? Is the thought real? Is the thought like just a wisp of wind when we think of I? And so he had a very central kind of way of keeping people on focus, pursuit of that I thought. But Neeb Karoli Baba took a different approach, I think, and teaching people that they need to really focus on the things that are holding them back from love and forgiveness. And I think that that's maybe more of a important prerequisite for doing the deeper work, because when we're very attached to aspects of ourself which are projected outward, then we can't really understand ourselves totally. So the forgiveness work has to be done, the acceptance, self-knowledge, self-acceptance, become the creator. That's the process. And the I thought quest to me is partly the becoming the creator, part of the discipline of the personality that Ra speaks of. But becoming the creator is not necessarily the same thing as recognizing the self as the creator. These are two different ways of looking at the same thing. And there, you know, these thoughts ultimately are just kind of converging around the source thought, which could be called the original thought, I think, in the Law of One terminology, the thought of self exploring in love the creation through many manifest forms.
Yeah. Well, we talk about identity a lot, and I couldn't agree more that I think ultimately that's sort of the core of any true teaching ultimately is to teach us that we've claimed an identity that is not accurate. And we do it in a lot of a million ways, right? Like we carry a lot of labels and identities and ways of knowing the self, including our thoughts, to your point. Sometimes we think that we are our thoughts as opposed to the one that's sort of conceiving them and evaluating them. So let's talk a little bit about the Law of One then. So I would like to know kind of, you know, in your words, given that, you know, you expose yourself to a good number of different traditions and sources of information, what is it about the Law of One that resonates so much for you?
Every word on the page. It feels like I'm being sucked into a very loving, peaceful consciousness that is compassionate enough to know how I can be receiving information, and compassionate enough to help me work through my issues without pushing something too strongly. They're very careful about how they deliver information, such that it's not ever harsh. Although that makes it confusing because they're so cautious with the way they're phrasing things. They don't want to push anyone to thinking something prematurely or in the wrong way. And are many times in the material, they say that, you know, our language is not overstrewn with non-emotional concepts to represent certain concepts like the astral forms. And there's so many things that are so hard to describe because our own language is so limited. But to the degree that our language can be used, they used it to, I think, its maximum efficiency. And it's like, it's an anchor that draws us back into that density of consciousness, which is more purely aware of the oneness of all polarities of all seeking.
So you've obviously find resonance in the answers. Do you find relatability to Don and his line of questioning? And or is it a mixed bag sometimes, you know, like,
yeah,
you, because yeah, there's two different things going on there.
Yeah, I love Don so much. I feel like I'm a part of me is Don, a part of Don is me. I'm just like merging with Don at some level. It's like his path of seeking felt like mine to some degree. He just wanted to know the truth. He was pursuing everything he could with ufology. And when that led to realization that they want to talk to us, they have things to say, and they've already been talking to people and trying to get this information through, then it's like, of course, that's what I want to know. I want to know all about what they want us to know. And, you know, they know more than anyone walking around here. So let's get to the bottom of it.
Well, that's a great segue, because I had on my list here, if you could ask Ra three questions, what would they be? And if you're too on the spot, don't come up with ones that, you know, wouldn't be pertinent. But if you could ask a burning question, what would you want to ask?
Well, I think you might be able to guess it right now because of our own pursuits. But the burning question right now is, can you give us some more examples of how one might use the other archetypes and what conditions in which one might apply the other major arcana archetypes in one's personal seeking at what points in time.
That would be hugely powerful. And for those watching that may not be as familiar with the material, Ra does provide exactly one perfectly good example, right? It's just a single yep. one, I think, of this is how, you know, this archetype would be used, and it makes perfect sense. It's the English is great. There's no esoteric or obscure language or anything. It's like a perfect explanation. And when you dive in and start studying these archetypes, you start to understand that they're so multifaceted that you can't simply just extrapolate even to archetypes of the same kind, but of a different complex. It's not even necessarily the same, but I would highly agree with you. That would be fantastic if they could have provided the other 21 examples.
And that one example that they did provide is still like the most useful that.
And I use it regularly, actually, in the exact, you know, terms that they deliver it in. And I'm like reminding myself like, oh yeah, this is the new mind. This is the, you know, what is it? The virgin mind, right? Like sort of untouched by biases.
I feel like I might as well read it to people because we're
sure.
They did not categorize it properly on this website. I will do a search for the exact phrase. You can search for the phrase new mind. Yep. So the question was, how is the knowledge of the facets of the archetypical mind used by the individual to accelerate his evolution? And they said, I am Ra. We shall offer an example based upon the first explored archetype or concept complex. And that archetype or concept complex was called the magician, and it's called the matrix of the spirit, and it's called consciousness.
Matrix of the mind?
Matrix of the mind, yeah. So the conscious mind of the adept may be full to bursting of the most abstruse and unmanageable of ideas, so that further ideation becomes impossible, and work in blue ray or indigo is blocked through overactivation. It is then when the mind is bursting of unmanageable ideas, it is then that the adept would call upon the new mind, untouched and virgin, and dwell within the archetype of the new and unblemished mind, without bias, without polarity, full of the magic of the logos. And so they give a little hint at the end there why this is the magician. This is full of the magic of the logos, to be able to separate yourself from all attachments, come back to the place of centered stillness, and from that place, seek.
All right. Do you have a second question that you would ask, Ra?
I guess I feel like there could have been more clarity on the relationship between mind and spirit and the shuttle. The nature of the shuttle of consciousness and the nature of the, like, why is LSD, for example, that they use opening a hole or gateway that is unpredictable? How is it that LSD or psychedelics would open up that in an unhelpful way or potentially less manageable way, less consistently usable way? And what is this process of opening up the spirit? What is the nature of that? It's probably way beyond words, but that's something you can intuitively get a sense of, I think, when you're starting to have experiences where you're touching on the connection to the intelligent infinity or infinite spirit. But it's a big question mark.
For sure. I would agree with you, though, that on a psychedelic, it would sort of stand to reason that if the veil is pulled back in a much more substantial way than what you're psyche might, you know, typically be accepting of, you know, it can be an extreme experience, very, very powerful and profound, but not one perhaps that your mind would create of its own accord, or at least maybe not pull the veil back quite so much, just because it is, you know, it's a very impactful experience. anything else that, I mean, obviously archetypes one was huge, and that would give us a couple years worth of content for the deep dive calls to go into that. But, anything else that, before we move on that you'd like to ask, Ra?
I suppose it would seem fair, because there's such a huge amount of controversy and divide, that if they could narrow down the nature of the transition period, and how the transition period to fourth density relates to harvest.
Yeah.
Does the harvest happen over the transition period, or is it at one point in time? That's a huge question.
Sure. And I have, you know, thoughts on that, but they're less relevant because really you're right. It is sort of left open to some level of conjecture and speculation. Lastly, have you ever encountered any people, person or opportunity in which you considered that you might have a chance to work either with Ra or any other channeled entity, either through your own capabilities or capacity or somebody that you've known? Has it ever occurred to you to, you know, like, would Mike, you know, fit into a similar group, just like Don and Carla and Jim did, to, you know, to pull something like this off and actually ask these kind of questions of Ra?
Yeah, I definitely thought about that. And different people do make me think of that. And eventually those people make me think, okay, maybe it wouldn't work. It's like there's just, everyone has their own baggage and challenges in life. And even Don and Carla and Jim, they were struggling to, you know, find a suitable location where Don had to, you know, go off and be an airline pilot. He couldn't just do that work. This world is not built to support this kind of seeking. And it's mysterious how that is. It's like,
it would be with free energy.
I potentially.
Mean, didn't Ra allude to that some of the technologies that were delivered through the Industrial Revolution were ultimately geared toward just creating more time for people to seek?
Yeah. Yeah. More time in the evenings, more time with lights so you can actually see.
And read.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's a question for another time in private, I think, to go into that.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear more. Okay. So, we've touched on medicines a little bit, and so I would like to, you know, if seeking, through spiritual text is digital, I guess for me anyway, the way that I see this, a psychedelic experience is sort of the analog, in spiritual experience. So, how has this looked for you? What part have psychedelics played, you know, kind of how would you characterize them? And, you know, what were some of the more poignant experiences?
Well, definitely the most significant experience would have been when I first opened up to LSD and took a 300 microgram dose sitting in a pyramid. Most of the day I was in the pyramid, and I feel like the pyramid was like a protective mechanism. It was 12 and a half foot at the base, 8 foot high copper pipes. And I did that so that my head would be around the King's Chamber position. And I felt that was very, very peaceful, healing space to be in. And when I, well, that's, there's so many aspects to that story. I guess the most significant thing of that day was a kind of feeling that I did not know who I was, and the vision that I was sort of falling behind with my selfish pursuits, and the role in which I had incarnated into necessitated that I walk hand in hand with those brothers of light that were beside me and catch back up and maintain that hand to hand. Like it was like a line that I saw of beings like myself that were holding hands and walking forward through the galaxy, through the cosmos, to do the work of bringing the healing that's needed. And unless we're working together, we're not really doing that healing work. So it was almost as though I was separating from the sense that I didn't have the purpose that I knew I had come for, and the sense of distractions that the ego can lead to were painfully apparent after that experience. And it felt like I was having to reclothe myself with a personality afterward that I didn't like. I didn't want that personality again, but I still had to work through it because this is somehow what I've allowed myself to be stuck with. And so I'll just keep chipping away at the distortions of the personality as I seek to become more purified. That was the first experience.
And has LSD been sort of, you know, in that role or, you know, have you had a similar relationship to it since?
I've never had anything quite like that with LSD. But everything is a reminder of the need to stay vigilant against the distortions of the ego and the temptations of self-aggrandizement and all that junk. And I think that I've been greatly benefited by MDMA to assist me in my seeking, because the distractions that come up with intense psychedelics can be, I feel like they can be worked with more comfortably with added assistance. And certainly Gotu-Kola is the number one thing that's helped me, which is not illegal. So Gotu-Kola is the plant medicine that I recommend to everyone, that's been the most beneficial. G-O-T-U space K-O-L-A. And I find that that is the one that, it's not like blowing open the veil, but it's cracking the door open just enough that that when I'm seeking in some way to worship the creator, to be more connected, then the reverence comes more naturally. The sacredness comes more obviously apparent, and I can work from a higher state more consistently with that. Yeah, certainly MDMA, and certainly my wife has been the biggest sort of catalyst to help me break through a lot of issues. And so having the MDMA with her was one of the most healing things for both of us. And so I certainly hope that one can become legalized. I know it's going through like FDA testing or something right now. Hopefully that can be completed. And sure, people can actually use that on maybe on a more similar level to the way they use ketamine, where they can go somewhere to have a good treatment plan and not just use it recreationally. Although that obviously is helpful.
But perhaps for more acute circumstances, PTSD, things like that, there's probably some benefit to a clinical approach. What about DMT? Where does DMT fall in with all these things?
Well, there was a time when I decided I really needed to try experiencing this DMT dimension thing everyone was talking about. So I bought some Chonga off the dark net, which was 50, a variety of herbs with mixed with DMT. And that was pretty easy to smoke in a bong and get a pretty good hit. And that's the hardest thing with DMT, is getting a very large amount in your lungs. You kind of have to have some practice getting through some pain experience with your lungs. But I was ready. I got a very, very large dose. And the first time I did it, I was able to go out of body, break through into this other place. And it was like the curtains kind of started to open, and it was like brighter, more vivid light, more colors than anything I'd seen with my physical eyes. And that was completely shocking. At first it was like a TV was turning on, but then I realized this is way more vivid than anything I've ever seen on any kind of television show. This is not like anything I could describe easily. But then after the curtains opened, and it was almost like there was two serpent figures. And then I was like, what is this? And then it was like, I looked up, and then I just shot out like a rocket into some other space, which was like an astral plane or something, where I felt that it was, I could see everything around me. It was kind of like, on some level, like a jungle where there was a wildness to it. And at some level, it's like a bustling city where there's, but I was in the middle of a city too, Colorado Springs, when I had this experience. So it would make sense if there was some feeling of city energy around me. But it was like I could look out and see all kinds of forms and figures in this other plane. And it was extremely dense, and it was extremely full of light and energy. And there were a few figures that were present that were all feminine, that were sort of wanting my attention. But I initially said, I want the highest light. I want the highest experience that I can. And so I kind of looked up, and I felt what felt like heavenly realms, like beyond description, a feeling of sacredness and a feeling of peace in some higher planes. And then I kind of dropped back down pretty quickly and got distracted again by these figures in front of me that were wanting my attention. Of course, when I first broke through, it was like there were like dozens of these entities wanting my attention. that were like, I would call them lower astral entities, because that's just what makes sense now, that they were kind of like at the bottom of this blast off experience, and they were all kind of reaching out trying to get my attention, and I didn't care about them, and so I just broke through all of them. And there were these higher entities that were seemingly more sophisticated in how they were trying to interact with me, and I was trying to figure out what their agenda was. And one of them in particular, I started to worry, is this secretly some kind of demonic thing trying to get my attention? And then that snapped me out of it. And then I lost everything back down to my body. So I can't say for sure what that was, but I feel like the nature of there being temptations being offered by astral entities was a much more clear concept to me after that.
On the DMT. Is interaction with other entities in and of itself a little bit more typical for you on a psychedelic, or was that more a DMT specific experience?
I don't know how to answer that necessarily. I feel like I always assume that there's some guides that are interacting with me, but I'm sort of more interested on the lesson, and I'm just happy to see the best lesson that they're trying to show me without it becoming about a dialogue as much as it is like a
what the message is, not focused on the meta, but what the real lesson that's available in that time and space is.
And making sure I'm communicating with the right entities is not very hard when you do the proper work up front, the proper preparations and prayers and clearings, and then when your heart is in the right space, it's very obvious what you're dealing with, has your best interest in mind.
Yeah, and I can't recommend that to people enough when they're, you know, starting to do almost any work in consciousness, that intention and alignment and, you know, what you carry into a space and what you claim will be your experience is what your experience will be. And so it's real helpful to claim that, you know, in a real high alignment. And and then I think you set yourself up for success. Anything else that you would I had this question I wanted to ask. If you could design a spiritual retreat, and this is things I'm sure that we've even talked about before, because a lot of people think about this, but if you were to to have your druthers, what would a spiritual retreat for you look like?
Oh, it's such an exciting concept. I've been wanting to have something that has a more reverent, sacred vibe to it for a long time, a dedicated space. I certainly want there to be pyramids for people to use, and it doesn't have to be anything too big or fancy, but just being able to be in pyramids oriented towards either north or 20 degrees east of north is a huge benefit. And certainly religious symbols can be helpful for people. Candles can be helpful. Incense can be helpful. Everyone's a little different, though. So it's like, I can't just say what I would like would necessarily be the way to build a center. It's like I could build my own room that would be perfect for me. And
I think each retreat honestly ends up looking and feeling a little different based on the collective that aggregates in that time and space. So yeah, if you were to design a center, that would, you know, probably look one way or be a little bit more broadly applicable to more people from more walks of life, I suppose. But if you were to host a retreat or have some of your, you know, closest spiritual seeking friends at a retreat, but it sounds like pyramids definitely there, religious and spiritual symbology definitely present. What about music? What sort of musical vibe would you lean
towards?
That is
so dependent on people too. I mean, I get so much out of even old hymns, just gentle soft music, but I still get a lot out of contemporary Christian worship too. But certainly that can even be its own trip when you're focusing on the lyrics versus allowing yourself to sort of silence your mind even more than that, which was certain. Obviously, ambient kind of music can be very helpful, and there's so much of that. And a part of me still wants to like explore, like, are there certain chord transitions in music theory where you could have certain transitions just continuously go up the scales, up the octaves gently. Maybe there are some types of music I want to explore, but that's like, that's such a long, it takes a lot of time to make music. So I don't know if I can get into that. But
oh,
that's,
man. No, I agree. But I'm also fascinated by that and cymatics and solfeggio frequencies and the notion of a different musical scale, right? Which, again, something for another day that we could dive into and just try to figure out that, you know, particular conspiracy theory in and of itself is just fascinating to think about that.
Oh, you mean the Hertz? The
yeah, the 440 versus the 432. And it's like, yeah,
and I'm actually,
most people that have never encountered that would have no idea what that even
yeah.
means and or is a thing. And it's fascinating.
I was strongly influenced by an article that I found talking about 432 is also a disinformation hoax. They're trying to pull us away from 444, which is the real, because there was like there's like the one of the frequencies that shows up when you're using 444 tuning for middle C is like the 532 that people know is associated with the heart, and it just shows up naturally in that scale.
Okay.
Whereas it doesn't show up naturally in 440 or 432. But 444 is what people, even like the Beatles, it's like what people are naturally tuning their instruments just to their ear, like in an orchestra, they may naturally tune it up a little bit. They don't turn it down a little bit. They tune it up a little bit to make it a little bit nicer sounding.
Interesting.
So I've tried experimenting with converting songs to be 444, and it's etheric, very nice experience.
Really?
To tweak them up just a little bit.
I didn't know that was even a thing. Well, definitely something for another time. I'd love to dive into that, though. We could do a call just about that. I know Nick would have a lot to offer, too. He's got a musical background, too, as I recall. But otherwise, Mike, I just so appreciate this today. Is there anything else that you'd like to kind of add in terms of your path and what's next? And I really appreciate you helping us understand kind of what's gotten you to this point. But if there's anything in the near future that, you know, you're warming up to get excited about, I'd love to hear it.
Well, I'm certainly, now that I've moved out into the mountains, I'm certainly excited to learn, you know, the best way to meditate in nature with others. And I know it's a long drive to get where I am right now, but I'm partly excited to see if there is a way to get more people meditating in nature in some structured way without needing to talk to each other, just enough to get where they need to be. I know that there's added benefit in speaking and seeking together, even if you're seeking inwardly. Somehow, when we're connected with other people and we're meditating together, that can be somehow exponentially more profound. And it's almost like there's an automatic connection without even there having to be any external clues. It's just people are going in together, and somehow the energy starts to connect and we're all connected. So doing that in nature also, I think, connects us to the trees that are already meditating around us on some level. And it's like we're becoming more united with the greater consciousness, which is seeking peace, which is Mother Gaia expressing itself through the nature around us and the just the natural state of being that we're all kind of trying to seek to for return sure. to.
I would be a yes for that for sure. As soon as you're ready to coordinate that, you can count me in. And yes, I will definitely echo what Valerie says and express immense gratitude to you on behalf of a number of communities and a lot of people that that I know you're doing just amazing work for, to pull people together and disseminate these beautiful messages that you've learned from all these interesting sources. So thank you for everything that you do, Mike, and thanks for your time today as well.
Thank you. And thank you for taking on this role of interviewer. And I'm sure you could do this much more if you wanted to. You structured it very well.
Oh, thanks. It'd be my pleasure.
Mm-hmm. All right. I guess we could say bye to recording right now and say hello to the people who are attending.
Sounds good.
All right. Take care.